And welcome to Sferio, the local voice of our hemisphere, here on WMBR Cambridge. I'm Amy Battistiache, and I'm joined here in our studio by the fabulous co-hosts, Kendra Johnson.
Hi, Amy.
And Froilan Cifuentes.
Hola a todos.
Hola a todos. We've got an hour coming your way of all sorts of good news and discussion and music and many different other exciting things. And one of the things that we're going to be doing is an interview about Nicaragua.
Indeed.
Nicaraguan water?
No, with renewable energy.
Renewable energy, okay. And I believe we have another Radialistas segment coming your way. Tenemos un montón de cosas, así que stick around.
Absolutely. But first, we'd like to remind you all that the views and opinions we express here on Sferio do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of WMBR, the Technology Broadcasting Corporation, or MIT.
Also, you're welcome to call us during the show at 617-253-8810 or email us in English, Espanol, Portuguese, or even French at sferio@wmbr.org.
That's Sferio at WMBR.org.
And you can catch this and all of our previous shows on the web, too, on archive section of at www.wmbr.org.
And more archives at web.mit.edu/hemisphere.
Exactamente. So, si tienes comentarios, si quieres hablar con nosotros, puedes llamarnos al 717-253-8810, ¿verdad? Mm-hmm. Yep. Vamos a seguir. Yo creo que lo que vamos a hacer,
I think we're going to start off with this interview. Maybe, Kendra, you can give us everybody...
Oh, no, noticias first. Listen to me being a...
Noticias news.
Noticias first. I think we'll start off with the noticias first. Let me introduce to you the fabulous noticia reader, Froilan Cifuentes.
Okay, so in Bolivia, hundreds of people gathered Wednesday outside the U.S. Embassy in La Paz to demand the extradition of former President Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada. The gathering came on the fourth anniversary of the Black October government crackdown that killed 67 protesters and wounded more than 400. The protesters had been opposing a decision to export Bolivia's natural gas through a port in Chile. De Lozada and two former top officials have resided in the U.S. since 2003, after a citizens' uprising removed them from office. Bolivia is seeking De Lozada's extradition. Black October victim's attorney, Rogelio Maita, quote, Sánchez de Lozada is trying to make out that the trial for the responsibility of the September and October 2003 massacres is a political persecution, but it isn't. This is a cause of justice and 4 years of justice in wanting. It is a part of the fight against impunity here in Bolivia, and as we consider it, for the whole American continent.
¿Qué dice? ¿Un poquito de traducción de esa noticia o qué? ¿Qué dice?
Yo creo que sí.
Así que lo que acabo de decir es que en Bolivia cientos de personas se han juntado el miércoles ante la embajada de Estados Unidos en La Paz para exigir la extradición de un expresidente de Bolivia, Sánchez de Lozada, Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada. Esto debido a que esto pasó en el cuarto aniversario de la represión del gobierno conocida como Octubre Negro, en la que 67 manifestantes murieron y más de 400 resultaron heridos. Los manifestantes se oponían a una decisión de exportar el gas natural de Bolivia a través de un puerto chileno, y Sánchez de Lozada y otros dos funcionarios, exfuncionarios, residen en Estados Unidos desde el año 2003, después de que un levantamiento popular lo sacó del poder. Bolivia está pidiendo que se le extradite al exmandatario. El abogado de las víctimas del Octubre Negro, Rogelio Maita, dijo, se ha pretendido hacer ver en este juicio en él de responsabilidades por la masacre de septiembre y octubre de 2003 una persecución política, pero no es así. Esa es una causa de justicia y 4 años de juicio mediante. Ya constituye parte de la lucha contra la impunidad acá en Bolivia y consideramos en todo el continente americano. A new study shows remittances from migrant workers to their home countries dwarfs the amount of international aid from the world's richest nations. The UN International Fund for Agricultural Development and the Inter-American Development say workers sent more than $300 billion to developing nations last year, nearly 3 times foreign development aid from world's leading donors. IFAD President Leonard Beige said the numbers call for easing barriers to remittances. Leonard Beige, quote, it's hard-earned money by poor people in rich countries, sending back to their families, but it has a potential. So let's make it easy to transfer, let's make it cheap to transfer, and let's build the financial system locally so it can really come to use in the local communities where it's destined to go. Y en español, un nuevo estudio indica que los giros de los trabajadores inmigrantes a sus países de origen, esto es los trabajadores que residen en los países de primer mundo, como se dice, hacen que los montos de ayuda internacional de los países más ricos del mundo parezcan pequeños. El Fondo Internacional para el Desarrollo Agrícola, el FIDA, de la ONU y el Banco de Desarrollo Interamericano dicen que el año pasado los trabajadores enviaron más de 300 mil millones de dólares a los países en vías de desarrollo, lo que representa prácticamente el triple de la ayuda extranjera para el desarrollo proporcionada por los principales donantes del mundo, 3 veces más. El presidente del FIDA, Leonard Beige, dijo que las cifras exigen que se disminuyan las barreras impuestas a los giros. Leonard Beige dijo, es dinero ganado con mucho sacrificio por personas pobres en países ricos, que se lo envían a sus familias, pero tiene potencial. Por lo tanto, hagamos que sea fácil transferir, hagamos que sea barato transferir y construyamos el sistema financiero a nivel local para que realmente pueda ser utilizado en las comunidades locales a donde está destinado. And one more headline. The House, and this is local news, well, the U.S. news. The House has failed to override President Bush's veto of a bill expanding health insurance to millions of children from low-income families. Supporters needed a two-thirds majority to overcome the veto, but not a single Republican who initially voted against the measures switched sides. The bill would have expanded the state children's health insurance program, known as S-CHIP, by $35 billion over 5 years. Democratic leaders say they will reintroduce the measure with minor changes next month. Meanwhile, Democratic Congressman Pete Stark has set off a furious Republican reaction with his comments on the House floor. Stark said, "You don't have money to fund the war on our children, but you are going to spend it to blow up innocent people if we can get enough kids to grow old enough for you to send to Iraq to get their heads blown off for the president's amusement." Stark has refused to apologize. Y una pequeña traducción en español. La Cámara de Representantes de Estados Unidos no logró reunir los votos necesarios para levantar el veto del presidente Bush a un proyecto de ley que buscaba expandir el seguro médico a millones de niños de familias de bajos ingresos. Quienes apoyaban la medida necesitaban una mayoría especial de 2/3 para levantar el veto. No obstante, ni uno solo de los republicanos que inicialmente habían votado en contra de la medida cambió su voto. Este proyecto de ley hubiera expandido el programa estatal de seguro médico para niños, S-CHIP en inglés, en $35 mil millones durante 5 años. Los líderes demócratas dicen que el mes que viene presentarán nuevamente la medida con pequeñas modificaciones. Mientras tanto, el congresista demócrata Pete Stark suscitó una reacción de furia por parte de los republicanos con sus comentarios en la Cámara de Representantes. Stark dijo, "No tienen fondos para la guerra o para los niños, pero van a gastar el dinero en asesinar a personas inocentes si logramos reunir la cantidad de niños necesarios con edad suficiente para que ustedes los envíen a Irak y les vuelen la cabeza para entretenimiento del presidente."
Eso sí fue increíble que lo dijo.
¿Eh? Stark se negó a disculparse por sus comentarios. Y se negó, claro.
Y vaya Stark, man.
Bueno, esos fueron three headlines and tres titulares. De noticias.
3 tristes titulares.
Sí, se mezcla el inglés y el español aquí.
Bueno, muchas gracias, Froilán, por las noticias.
Thank you, Froy.
So you're listening to Sferio, the local voice of our hemisphere, here on WMBR in Cambridge. That was just the news segment, which we like to start off our show with every week. And now we're going to be moving into an interview that I pre-recorded with a guest here in WMBR about a week ago. and happy that we have time today to share this with you all. So the interview is with a young man named Matthias Craig, who was a graduate student at MIT in the Civil and Environmental Engineering Master's program a number of years back.
What number is that?
What course number is it?
Yes.
It is course one. He was a course one master's student. If you want to learn the MIT lingo.
MIT code.
MIT code. And he actually, after his graduation, started a nonprofit organization called Blue Energy. And that's what the interview is all about. And so if any of our listeners are in front of computers and would like to sort of be browsing through more information about this organization, they have a fantastic website, which is www.blueenergygroup.org. And some quick facts. Essentially, it's an organization that is providing renewable energy to communities that have never had electricity before through a combination of wind and solar systems. And you'll hear Matthias talk about that during the interview. And they've now installed 8 systems in Nicaragua, serving 6 different communities for a total of 1,500 people who are now have access to electricity who never have before as a result of Blue Energy.
Wow.
So it's a pretty impressive thing, and it's a pretty radical, inspiring move to get that master's degree and then decide to head off to Nicaragua and start putting in renewable energy systems and making a difference in the world.
You know, that's what we're about here at Sferio. We want people to be getting whatever education they can, be that at MIT or through other means, perhaps through listening to what
Sferio.
We have to say at Sferio. And then getting out there and making change happen.
Of media outlets. Exactly. So we'll play some minutes of this interview and break it up with some other segments that we have for you today on Sferio.
Muy bien. Seguiremos. If you want to call us during the interview, you can do so at 617-253-8810.
This is Kendra Johnson from Sferio, the local voice of our hemisphere. I'm here today in the studio with Matthias Craig, who is a graduate from the master's program in civil environmental engineering here at MIT, and one of the founders and the executive director of Blue Energy. Also here with me is Ferlan Cifuentes, co-host of Sferio. So Matthias, just to begin, could you sort of tell us the story of Blue Energy? How did it get started off?
Oh, it's a long story. I'd say the short version is that I started developing a real interest in Nicaragua when I was young because of my mother, who's a linguist, MIT-trained linguist, who was teaching at the U of O at the time. Started working with the Rama Indians on the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua, documenting their dying language. This was part of a language revitalization project. She started working there in 1985 and started taking my brother and I down there starting in 1989. And so we got sort of developed a relationship with that area at that time. So that's sort of the interest in Nicaragua, that side of things. From the technology side, I first got interested in wind power when I was studying at UC Berkeley as an undergrad in the environmental engineering program. Started taking some courses in the energy and resource group and was instantly hooked by wind power. It seemed to present the perfect opportunity to do something that was very technically challenging, very international, and very environmentally friendly at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And then here at MIT, you were enrolled in a course.
Right. So when I got to MIT, I already sort of had those two pieces working for me. And then I took a class called Entrepreneurship in the Developing World here with Sandy Pentland, Professor Sandy Pentland and Joost Bonson. And the whole point of that class was to build interdisciplinary teams to develop products and services to help the world's 2 billion poorest people. Most innovation does go towards products and services for the people who are already the richest. So this was sort of, you know, turning the table around. So that's where we sort of formalized the idea of Blue Energy and sort of brought the interest in Nicaragua and the interest in wind power together to start the organization.
Mm-hmm. And then you graduated from MIT?
I did. I graduated in 2003. And carried the project on beyond the class environment. We submitted a business plan to the MIT. It was the 50K competition at the time, a little less valuable than it is now. And we were actually selected as winners in the warm-up 1K competition in the fall. in the global markets category. And, you know, $1,000, you can hardly do anything with that. But the momentum that it gave me to sort of the encouragement to take the idea out of the classroom and do something with it, that was invaluable.
Mm-hmm. So what was the model? What was the idea behind Blue Energy?
We've evolved quite a bit since the very beginning. The model that was submitted here for the class project was actually a for-profit organization building micro wind turbines and installing them on the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua for water purification only. So we were going to integrate it with UV radiation technology to do low-cost water purification. So we weren't really interested in electrification per se. It was just electricity for water purification.
Mm-hmm.
So we weren't going to be doing lighting and just sort of the bigger community development picture. After a trip down to Nicaragua to sort of explore the reality down there and the business environment and talking with potential investors, it became very clear that the proposition was way too risky to do as a for-profit. We couldn't do what we wanted to do with the strong social mission, where we wanted to do it, and bring in investors. You had to choose what you wanted to do the most. And so we sort of changed the model, went and incorporated as a nonprofit organization after I left MIT. And that's really just been key, because it's a very high-risk environment, technology-wise, environment-wise, politically. You need to have that public support. And, you know, we were starting with very few resources, so we needed to rely on in-kind contributions, experts giving us advice, and things that in the business world are very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
We needed to have access to those. So the nonprofit structure made sense.
Mm-hmm. Matthews, can you tell us a little bit about the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua and the area you're working in?
We're based out of Bluefields, Nicaragua, in the Ras, in the southern Atlantic Autonomous Region of Nicaragua. It's very isolated. The entire coast is very isolated, in particular the southern Atlantic Autonomous Region. There's no roads connecting the Pacific coast to the Caribbean coast. There's essentially no civil infrastructure to speak of outside of Bluefields. And Bluefields, the biggest town on the coast, it's about 50,000 people. Even there, you only have a limited number of paved roads. The electric grid is very unreliable. There's no water service. So even within that town, there's very little infrastructure. You go outside of Bluefields by boat or by horseback because there aren't any roads. You can't get in. You can't drive in or out of Bluefields. And you go outside of Bluefields, and I mean, there's no infrastructure at all, none. So it's the Wild West of the United States from 1800 or 1750. I mean, that's people do ride around on horses, and it's like. There's no infrastructure going up and down the coast either. So there's no roads interconnecting the villages. So everything's by boat. It's really a marine environment. I mean, people, if you're going to go from community to community, you do it by the ocean or by the rivers.
And are there people primarily of indigenous descent? Or?
It's a real mix. It's really a cultural melting pot, if you will. There's a couple different indigenous groups, the Rama Indians, the Ulua, the Mosquito. The Garifunas, and then there's a lot of Creole, black Creole population. I don't know the exact numbers, but it might be half of the population on the coast. And then you also have what they call the Spaniards, the people descended from the Pacific side, which was colonized by Spain, while the Caribbean side was colonized by the English. The Spaniards have been slowly encroaching towards the Caribbean because of arable land, a wide availability of land they could farm and do ranching. So that's been causing a lot of tensions. There's a lot of sort of violence and tensions around land rights issues because the indigenous groups tend to have community property, and the Spaniards, the mestizos, are coming in and building fences and marking off private land, and there's a lot of conflict about that right now.
Mm-hmm. So most people make their living by fishing. And we're talking
in about the communities that we're working on, really, really on the coast. Yeah, it's primarily fishing.
Mm-hmm.
In most of the little communities, it's subsistence living. You know, people are fishing, maybe doing a little bit of yuca, a little bit of agriculture. Families often raise like one pig or one cow, and then if everybody in the community has one animal, they kind of share the meat or you know, sell it in town, make some revenue.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's primarily subsistence living. And then what families often do is they have one of their sons, at least one of their sons, working in the boats, either commercial fishing, doing lobster or shrimp a little bit farther out in the ocean, or almost every family on the Caribbean coast has a son in working on the cruise ships
mm-hmm.
in the Caribbean. So a lot of money in there comes from actually work on the boats.
Work on the boats.
Yeah.
So what does Blue Energy have to offer a community like that?
And we'll get back to the answer to that question right after a little musical interlude. You're listening to Sferio, the local voice of our hemisphere here on WMBR in Cambridge. This is an interview with Matthias Craig, who is the founder and executive director of Blue Energy, a nonprofit in Nicaragua. If you're interested in finding out more about that organization and what they do, you can visit their website at www.blueenergygroup.org. So now we're going to listen to some music from Nicaragua to get us into the mood, and we'll return to the last half of the interview after that.
If you're going to listen to any music at all that's about or related to Nicaragua, you pretty much have to at some point listen to this song, Nicaragua, Nicaragüita, by the Mejia Godoy brothers. And here it is being sung, I believe, by Luis Enrique and Carlos, both together. And we'll be listening to it here on the Great 88.
Ay, Nicaragua, Nicaragüita, recibe como prenda de amor este ramo de siempre vivas y jilinjoches que hoy florecen para vos. Cuando yo beso tu frente pura, beso las perlas de tu sudor, más dulcita que la frutita del tiguilote. Y el jocote tronado. Ay, Nicaragua, Nicaragüita, recibe como prenda de amor este ramo de siempre vivas y jilinjoches que hoy florecen para vos. Cuando yo beso tu frente pura, beso las perlas de tu sudor, más dulcita que la frutita del tiguilote y el jocote trona.
Tonight I want to take a few minutes to discuss a grave threat to peace, a grave threat to peace, a grave threat to peace.
Do you think the U.S. should maintain a military presence in Iraq? Our president declared mission accomplished some 3 years ago. Yet since then, thousands of American troops and tens of thousands of Iraqis have died. Basic necessities like drinking water and electricity are scarce.
If you love this land of the free,
bring them home, bring them home.
Bring all troops back from overseas.
So if you want to bring our troops home now, then join the anti-war demonstration Saturday, October 27th on Boston Common. The Iraqi people want us out. A majority of Americans want us out.
It's time to go home. To take our boys away now. To take our girls away now. To take our boys
Saturday, October 27th, 12 noon on Boston Common. Support our troops by bringing them safely home to their families. Sponsored by United for Justice with Peace and Military Families Speak Out. For more information, go to www.justicewithpeace.org.
Je ne veux pas travailler.
Je me lève et je te bouscule.
Il faut se lever tous les matins.
Elle est belle comme le matin.
Paris se lève.
6h du mat, j'ai des frissons.
Oh no, another Monday morning and you have to get up. Well, wake up and smell the croissant. Every Monday from 6 to 8, we bring you French toast, 2 hours of the best French language music, concert reports, and news of what's going on around town. We also do ticket giveaways and we play your requests. So listen to French Toast every Monday morning from 6 to 8, right here on WMBR Cambridge.
Well, this is WMBR, of course, and you're listening to a very creative version of Sferio, the voice of your hemisphere. And we had been hoping that we were going to bring you back to our interview with Matias that we were listening to before, a guy who's been doing some really wonderful work in Nicaragua. And we were playing a little bit of the fabulous Nicaragua Nicaragüita song for you, but then we've been having some technical difficulties, so please excuse us while we struggle through that. We'll hope to get you back to the rest of that interview a little bit later in today's show. It's 6:30 and it's 88.1 FM. You can listen to this and previous versions of Sferio by checking us out on the web at www.wmbr.org. And I think that what we're going to do next is just go right into Radialistas, a free and downloadable piece in Spanish that comes to you here on Sferio from Radialistas Activas y Activos, Apasionados y Apasionados. And this particular one is commemorating the Week of Disarmament, which is usually the last week of October. But we thought that we might play it today in honor of the aforementioned comments from your congresspeople and ours today. So here's Radialistas.
Fabricantes de guerras.
Si usted vende abrigos, se alegra cuando llega el invierno.
Si usted comercia con insecticidas, necesita la aparición de plagas.
Y naturalmente, si usted fabrica armas, necesita guerras donde esas armas se puedan emplear.
Pero, ¿qué hacer si no hay guerras?
Hay que fabricarlas. De lo contrario, la industria bélica, una de las tres más rentables del mundo, junto con la droga y el petróleo, se paralizaría.
En los últimos 50 años, no ha habido un solo día de paz en nuestra tierra. Durante la llamada Guerra Fría, desde 1945 a 1988, se desataron 43 conflictos entre países y 60 guerras civiles.
En el mercado mundial de armamentos, Estados Unidos acapara la mitad de todas las ventas.
Muchas armas se venden en la propia Norteamérica. Se calculan 230 millones de armas de fuego en manos de ciudadanos estadounidenses. Esto da un promedio de un arma por persona adulta.
A Estados Unidos le sigue Inglaterra, con un 19% del mercado total de armas. Después vienen Francia y Rusia.
No es casual que Estados Unidos, el mayor fabricante de armas, sea también el mayor fabricante de guerras en el mundo.
Desde su independencia hasta la fecha, los Estados Unidos, sin haber sido atacados, han enviado sus tropas 216 veces en contra de otras naciones.
Desde el fin de la Segunda Guerra Mundial, Estados Unidos ha bombardeado 23 países.
Por cada dólar que la Organización de Naciones Unidas emplea en misiones de paz, Estados Unidos invierte $1,000 en gastos militares.
La guerra es un negocio muy rentable. La última gira de Condoleezza Rice por Medio Oriente no fue para resolver conflictos, sino para vender armas.
La secretaria de Estado norteamericana logró jugosos contratos por 20 mil millones de dólares con los países del Golfo, 30 mil millones de dólares con Israel y 13 mil millones de dólares con Egipto.
La guerra es un negocio redondo. Se venden armas, se conquistan territorios, se controlan reservas petroleras y mercados de drogas.
La supremacía.
So that was a Radialista's production about the weapons industry in the world. And for those of our members of our listening audience that are not able to understand the Spanish, we're going to now translate this into English for you. So, if you manufacture coats, you look forward to the winter.
If your business is pesticides, you need plagues.
And naturally, if you make weapons,
you need wars where the weapons will be deployed.
But what do you do if there aren't any wars?
You have to make them. Otherwise, the military industry, one of the three most profitable ones in the world, together with drugs and oil, will grind to a halt.
During the last 50 years, there has not been a single day of peace on Earth. During the so-called Cold War, from 1945 until 1988, 43 conflicts erupted between countries, and there were 60 different civil wars.
In the world arms market, fully half of the sales are from the United States.
Many weapons are sold right in North America. It is calculated that 230 million firearms are in the hands of U.S. citizens right now. That's an average of one gun per adult.
The U.S. is followed by England, with 19% of the total arms market. After them come France and then Russia.
It's no coincidence that the biggest producer of arms in the world is also the biggest manufacturer of war.
Since its independence, the United States has sent its troops against other countries 216 times without having been attacked by any of them.
And since the end of World War II, the United States has bombed 23 countries.
For every dollar the UN spends on peacekeeping missions, the U.S. invests 1,000 more on the military.
War is a very profitable business. Condoleezza Rice's most recent tour of the Middle East wasn't to solve conflicts, but to make sales of weapons.
The U.S. Secretary of State obtained juicy contracts amounting to $20,000 million with the Gulf states, $30,000 million with Israel, and $13,000 million with Egypt.
War is a circular business. Countries sell arms, take over territories, control oil reserves, and drug markets.
All of which is a reason to remember that next week is the week of disarmament around the world.
Indeed. And of course, we remind our listeners that the views and opinions we express here do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of WMBR, the Technology Broadcasting Corporation, or MIT. But we like to share these perspectives. And I think it's a really amazing statistics to think about, the fact that half of the arms trade in the entire world is conducted by the United States. And how many countries was it that we invaded without? Or
I believe 216.
Or interventions.
Yes.
With soldiers or bombs and such like things. And how many? And how many times have we been intervened in by other countries?
Yes,
so
right.
things to think about here on Sferio. And we apologize for the technical difficulties with the interview. We now have that ready to roll again where we left off. If you remember, we were talking to Matthias Craig, with Blue Energy about his work and his organization's work in Nicaragua, in Blue Fields, Nicaragua, the Caribbean side of that country.
Is that why it's called Blue Energy?
I believe there is the connection there.
Ah, I was wondering what it was, like if it was about, you know, Massachusetts is a blue state.
I think, and it also has the sort of natural theme there, that it's preservation of water and resources in the world. So we have a blue world and we have blue energy, and it's good.
Nice.
In Blue Fields,
in blue
Nicaragua.
Fields, Nicaragua.
So stay with us here on Sferio as we return to this interview with Matthias Craig.
Yeah.
So what does Blue Energy have to offer a community like that?
So what Blue Energy is doing now is we manufacture our own wind turbines locally in Blue Fields, and we build other things that are related to the system, like the tower for the wind turbine, the power center, various other subcomponents. And we do all that manufacturing locally with the local staff that we've been training over the last couple of years. And the idea really is to spark some economic development in that area, do something positive. And then that's one side of it, is really strong social mission. The other side is the philosophy that it's actually a lot easier to maintain the systems and keep them running year in, year out if it comes from a local capacity. If these people build it, then they know how to maintain it, right? So that's the philosophy. So Blue Energy builds these systems, and then we do the installations in the community, and then we work with the community over a long period of time. That's one of our real strengths, is that we're there to stay, and we work with them over and over and over. And that's what's needed. I mean, you're going to communities that have never had power before. You can't just build a power system, install it, and then like, oh, great, that's the end of this fabulous tale, you know? It's like they, you know, don't know what to do with the power. They don't know how to use it. They don't know how to maintain the system. So you're really starting from scratch, and you need to build that local capability. So we work very closely with the communities, training the operators in the communities. And then more and more now, we're starting to work with the treasurer. We're forming energy commissions in each community and working with the treasurers about basic financial skills, basic accounting, and just a lot of training like that.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe a little bit the technical part of the system? Where does the power come from? How is it stored? How does it get to the people?
Well, we manufacture the wind turbine in Bluefields. It's a different type of small wind turbine than most of the micro wind turbines that you can see in the U.S. or in Europe or elsewhere. It's designed to be simple to build, as simple as a complex machine can be to build. The wind turbine produces wild AC, wild alternating current, which is variable voltage, variable frequency. So that can't be used directly. So that electricity is converted to direct current in the power center, and then that's used to charge a bank of batteries. So this windmill design is for battery charging. You can't run appliances directly off of it. And then on the back end, you have a choice. You can either use the power directly out of the battery bank. It has to do with the kind of appliances that you have. So the appliances, fans, TVs, radios are either rated AC or DC. The vast majority are AC because most people, you know, grid power is AC. So most appliances that you buy are AC. But because of the boating community, there are DC appliances. So you can either use that power directly or use an inverter on the back end and convert it back to alternating current, but clean alternating current, which is essentially indistinguishable from the grid. So then it's like grid power. So generally what we do in these communities is we'll build a community battery charging station somewhere centrally located in the community. And then individuals will put in home electrification kits in their homes, which would be a deep cycle battery, wiring, lights, you know, circuit protection, those kinds of things. And then they carry those batteries to the charging center, you know, much like driving your car to a fuel station. And then they pay a fee to charge the battery. And that's really key because people, you have to have money for the operation and the maintenance of the system. And that's what most projects seem to forget. It's very hard to get funding, like ongoing funding for maintenance stuff. So somewhere you have to do some revenue generation within the project itself. So charging people a fee for them to charge their batteries builds up the energy fund, which can be used for spare parts and to pay the operators and et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Matthews, I think we're running out of time that we have for this interview, but I wanted to ask you one last question, which is sort of on a personal level. What are your reflections on your choice after graduating from MIT and deciding to go for this blue energy model that you had, you know, at that time was on paper and an idea? And how do you reflect on that?
I definitely think about that a lot. It's been a real wild ride ever since I left MIT, and on one hand, you know, we've been through all the struggles of forming our own organization, building our own organizational capacity, and at the same time trying to run projects and sort of learning how to juggle those things. I feel like I'm in school more than ever before. You know, every day I'm learning about international relations, about accounting, about real life engineering. It's been an incredible learning experience. I think in hindsight, it's not 100% clear that forming our own organization was necessarily the right path to take. I'm very proud of what we've built, and I think we're starting to be very successful. So I think, you know, we can look back and say, yeah, it was a good decision. But I think it's very important for people to, going forward, if they're thinking about doing something like this, to really give it good thought about whether it makes more sense to work, start a program within an existing organization with sort of like-minded ideals. But, you know, we did it the hard way, and we've learned so much because of it, and it's worked for us. But as I said before, it's a very high-risk proposition. You know, we have been a lot of struggles along the way, and we, just by being sort of bullheaded, we've got through it. But, you know, in hindsight, that might have been an easier path. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it'd be better, but it would have been easier.
Yeah. Well, Matthias, thank you very much for joining us, and we wish you the best in your continuing endeavors.
Thank you.
All right. I'm just going to stop it now, and we'll be all done.
Okay.
And that was Matthias Craig speaking about Blue Energy. Once again, that website is www.blueenergygroup.org for any listeners who'd like to find out more information about that organization. Then they also accept volunteers on an ongoing basis, so if anybody wants to go down and actually help install or maintain or observe and participate in these activities, there's that possibility too.
That's very exciting.
It is indeed. So I think maybe Freud and I can share a little bit of our perspective on this organization. The reason we wanted to bring this on to Sverio as an interview was because I think it's a really neat story, personal story from Matthias, but also a neat model. And I think they've got a lot of the necessary components down right from my limited experience working on water system in Ecuador, but also just being in small rural communities in developing countries, that there's such the paradigm is that you set up a infrastructure system and set up the local system for them to be able to maintain it, and then you walk away. And the local governments essentially do that, and non-governmental organizations do that, and church groups do that. And it's not because they don't have good intentions. I think they have the greatest intentions. But if you don't have somebody on the ground who's there for people to come to when things go wrong and as an ongoing source of advice and technology and parts and that kind of a thing, water systems, energy systems, all of that kind of stuff tends to fall apart.
I think it's one of the things that you learn while being on the spot. You are, maybe Matthias also learned that this way, like he went there and noticed or thought about like how could he make his efforts be sustained after he left the community or after he left the town. And of course you find out that the answer is not just, you know, leave the infrastructure there, but leave also the human resources, human infrastructure there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they have a good combination of training a local person who's doing most of the day-to-day work and the ongoing maintenance of the system, but they also have the resources in place for when larger issues develop or need to replace a larger part and that kind of a thing. So I think it's a really neat story. And now I think we're going to do a musical break. What music have you selected?
Freud seleccionó la música de hoy. La segunda canción, vamos a decir. I take responsibility for the first selection. But this one is something that Freud, you had said that you'd like us to play. And I believe that it is from the group called Jaramar. Is that not right?
Yeah.
And it's called La Tortuga. And it's off of Putumayo.
And it's in Huavi, one of the indigenous languages in Mexico. It's only spoken in three towns in the whole country and in the whole world. So it is, you could consider it's a dying language. If it's not dying, it's quite small.
Wow.
Do you know if it's still actively being taught to the young people in those three communities?
I don't know, but it's spoken in Oaxaca, and it is not Zapoteco, which is like the main language, and the people that go to Oaxaca maybe know about Zapoteco and not about Huavi.
No kidding. Apparently, I'm reading from the liner notes here, this song is about eating la tortuga or turtle turtle eggs. And there's usually a dance that goes along with the song, I guess. So. Neat. Let us listen to that, and then we'll come back and give you a little bit of suggestions for what you might do with some of the time that you might have coming up as we head towards the weekend. Who knows what else we'll give you. It's just a bundle of mysteries here at Sperio. Bueno, y esa fue una canción cantada en la música, en el idioma, ¿cómo se dice? El idioma
Huave.
Huave, ¿verdad? Idioma indígena de allá de México. La canción La Tortuga. And of course, you're listening to it here on Sperio, the local voice of your hemisphere. And now we're going to give you some very, very local events that you might consider going to here in our hemisphere in the next couple of days.
In the announcement section.
In the announcement section of our show. You guys should feel free, people who listen to the new improved Sperio, tell us what you think. You wouldn't know it today, but we're really trying to give you a more structured show. And we would love to hear from you. So our email address is sperio@... MIT.
WMBR.org.
Right. I shouldn't even try. Okay. First of all, the BLIF, otherwise known as the Boston Latino International Film Festival, which began last week is still continuing. This is the 6th annual BLIF Film Festival, and there are plenty of things that one can go see. These are happening today, tonight rather, over at the MFA, the Museum of Fine Arts, and they go on as well tomorrow, and I believe that Sunday is the final day. Tonight's show you might have already missed, actually, because there's only one that started at 5:45. But they are on all day, on Saturday and on Sunday. And as usual with the BLIF, they are featuring many different film talents and types of films. Films that are coming up on the weekend for some reason do not want to show up on my screen at the moment, but on Saturday there will be a selection of them in the afternoon at Boston University, here we go, with a series of shorts, U.S. Latino shorts, at 4 p.m., and Immigrant Reflections, local service workers in a documentary with the director doing a question and answer period afterwards, as well as Jenny Alexander's video, Mario, and her second video, New Bedford Stories. Jenny Alexander, a local film director who has been doing a number of different documentaries about current immigrant life in the Boston area. So who knows? If you go, you might even see somebody you know. So that's happening all weekend. As well, tomorrow in the afternoon, here on the MIT campus, you can learn how to dance Casino Rueda. ¿Usted sabe lo que es Casino Rueda?
Yo no.
Es un grupo de baile aquí en MIT.
Sí, es un estilo de salsa. Okay, it's a kind of salsa dance, the Cuban version of salsa called Salsa Casino or Casino Rueda. And it is very much a group experience in which you dance with one partner and then the circle moves and then you have a different partner and it's all very complicated and choreographed. And they'll teach you how to do it if you're so inclined, with lessons from 12 to 2 p.m. This is on Sunday, right? October 21st. And actual social dancing happening from 2 to 3 p.m. And it is located at the MIT Student Center, which is called
W20.
Thank you. And on the second floor. Anybody can come. Any level of dancing is welcome. And you don't even have to have a partner if you want to come check that out. And then Sunday night, we also have here on the MIT campus a lecture by Ramzi Barut, The Second Palestinian Intifada, Chronicle of a People's Struggle. This is the author of the book by that title, who will be giving a presentation about his book and will be doing a question and answer period afterwards, as well as book signing. This is being sponsored by the Arab Student Organization. And you can find out more information about it by contacting that group at arab-comm@mit.edu, like Arab-community, Arabcom. But it's happening from 7 to 9 p.m. at yet another number, 4237. For the MIT people, you already know what that means. For those of us who aren't really MIT people, I have to say 4 is the building, 237 is the room number. Okay. Let's see. Anything else going on in the area that you guys think we should let you know about?
I don't know if I have
about
any other announcements, but I have a couple of interesting points, which is
good.
That I was just checking out this, the last week we had on some guests from Chiapas, Mexico, and they from Yapsic, and working on health and health promotion education in Chiapas. And they mentioned that they have connections with a independent radio station there.
Cierto.
And they have an amazing website. So that website, it's 99.1 Frecuencia Libre desde San Cristóbal de las Casas, Chiapas, México. That's in at www.frecuencialibre.org. F-R-E-C-U-E
NCIALIBRE.org. So they also have a really neat page on there that has links to all kinds of other independent radio projects, and mostly in Spanish in Latin America. So Spanish language listeners, I recommend checking out that site. And the other thing that I brought in here is that there was a recent report that came out looking at what will happen if we ramp up production of corn for biofuel here in the United States, which is part of Bush's energy plan for indeed, and he's been promoting it. And so actually a professor that I'm taking a course with here at MIT, but a professor in the environmental engineering department here named Lara Entecavi was one of the authors of this paper, and essentially it was saying that we really have to consider very seriously growing corn and expanding biofuel crops, because it's going to dramatically increase the demand on resources, especially water, but also contamination of water and eutrophication from fertilizers and those sorts of environmental concerns with growing corn. Always good to keep our eye on the environment here on Sferio.
Pues sí. And if you have a topic that you think we should be covering on Sferio, you should let us know. But otherwise, just tune in again next Friday. We'll be with you from 6 to 7, as always. Here's a little bit of Legión Urbana to make your day with Brazilian rock and roll.
And before that, we'd like to remind you that, as always, the views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of WMBR, the Technology Broadcasting Corporation, or the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Muy, muy chévere. Yes, indeed. So, do not go away. Stay tuned for Music for Human Beings right after this.